Ladies and gentlemen, get ready for a marathon of a podcast today. Not just because our very substandard chat will make you feel like you've ran about 42.2 kilometres, but because the wonderful Fergus Davis completed the London Marathon last week. However, it didn't quite go according to plan, which is a little cliffhanger that I'll leave right there, which is something we discuss in detail in this chat, as well as touching on other things such as starting a business, living in Shanghai, and finally putting to bed the age-old question of how many fosters it takes to convince someone to live with you. So on your marks, get set, and enjoy. Fergus Alexander Kennett Davis.
Nailed it.
Firstly, congratulations on a fantastic name.
Thank you. Yeah, my mother would be proud.
That's really good.
They were between Fergus and Alexander, and they were indecisive, so they'd name me both.
So you could have been an Alexander Fergus.
Could have been. But actually, were it not for my grandmother, I would have been called Murray, which would have been a whole different chapter.
That's very Scottish.
Yeah.
Do you have Scottish roots?
Yeah, my mum's side. My mum grew up on a small island on the Scottish coast.
Named?
Millport.
Lovely.
Isle of Cumbrae, yeah.
We met in Scotland.
We did. Yeah.
Edinburgh.
You slept on my sofa a number of times.
Yes. After a few eventful cocktails that we used to drink together. Well, moving swiftly on.
We're 1 minute and 10 into the podcast.
Yeah,
already come up.
I was keen to have you on because I wanted to tell you all about how I ran the London Marathon a couple of years ago.
I'd love to hear about it. How successful it was.
No, you recently completed the London Marathon, which no doubt we're going to get onto.
I'm sure we will.
But first, I was going to say name, but we've been for your name.
Yeah.
So, and I was going to say where you're from, but we've kind of touched on that as well. So I'm running out of questions.
It's flowing so naturally. Though.
Goodness me. Well, where are you from and what's your favourite London landmark?
I'm from London. I grew up in South London. My favourite London landmark, am I allowed to say Stamford Bridge? Does that count? If it wasn't Stamford Bridge, I mean Tower Bridge.
It's great.
Tower Bridge is, you know, even before I ran the marathon, it had a special place in my heart. And yeah, big fan of Tower Bridge and otherwise close second St Paul's, I'd say.
Great. Is that for sentimental reasons? Architectural reasons?
I think St Paul's definitely architecturally. Yeah, in my sort of first year of study, you had to do kind of...
paint the picture, no pun intended.
Yeah.
You are an architect.
I'm an architect, yeah. Went to... when did I graduate? Probably 6 or 7, maybe slightly longer, years ago. Went to Edinburgh University, did my first two parts of my degree there, which was about 6 years of studying. And in that first year, you literally have a drawing board and a pencil and you have to draw to scale things like St Paul's. So, you know, you learn to have an affinity for these kind of things when you spend 5 hours drawing them. As fun as that is. But yeah, no, I'm an architect. I studied at Edinburgh. And then I've worked in London, worked in Shanghai for a few years. And I recently have started my own practice with one of my good friends.
Shout out
itself.
What a man.
Beautiful man. We were discussing before, he's probably the world's nicest man.
He is.
What the hell he's doing in business with me, I don't know.
I was going to say, good cop, bad cop. Yeah. He is a very pure, wholesome individual.
Absolutely, yeah.
Stamford Bridge.
Yep.
So because this podcast is kind of mental health related, mm-hmm. being a Chelsea fan these days must be...
Yeah, it's obviously, you know, on paper it looks like it's been a tough season, but what has helped me console myself, you know, make amends with it, is that you can't win a Champions League every year. And, you know, we've had the pleasure of winning Champions League twice in the last 10 years. So, yeah. You know, you've got to give other people a chance, and we're going to we're going to bow out of the Champions League for about the next 10 years to let other people do it. So
take the rough with the smooth.
Got to take the rough with the smooth. Yeah, no, it's not been great, but you know, I've been able to get more tickets this year than I might have done, so every cloud.
What's your thoughts on Todd Bowley? So bearing in mind how many listeners this podcast gets and how influential it is, you can really make a statement right now.
You know, I applaud that he's trying to disrupt the industry. I think he's a little scattergun, let's put it that way. And I think he's doing no wonders for the kind of perception of Americans in football. All the good work that Ted Lasso has done over the last few years is being undone by Mr. Bowley. Yeah.
Well, we might as well chat the London Marathon. So, I mean, where to start? You know what? Let's not jump straight into it. Do you want to give a bit of context behind why you decided to run it first?
Yeah. Well, I think it's something I've always wanted to do. You know, growing up in London, it's, you know, it's very much a part of the calendar every year. You watch it on the telly, you go down, you see it, you get in the crowd. Something that's always been on my bucket list. And I think I've gone in the ballot maybe 7 times and never got a place. And this year was the first year where I didn't get the ballot. And I thought, well, maybe I've got a chance of persuading some of my friends to stump up a few quid and get to the minimum charity donation level. So I looked through the list of the charities and there was one that was very close to my heart, which was the RNIB, which is looks after the blind people. So I applied for them. And you kind of have to put a bit of a sort of application in about why you deserve to run for them. And luckily, they picked me. So I was one of their team to run. And why this year did I go for charity?
Plug your Just Giving page.
Yeah, true. Yeah. You know, 20% of donations happen after the race is finished. I was recently told. So
four,
yeah,
if you 40% if you're on a podcast.
Exactly. If you want to support the cause, you know,
we'll put it
Just
in the
Giving
show notes.
Will be in the show notes. Yeah,
in the show notes. That's what they say.
And I, you know, I'm already
need to figure out how to do that. But yeah. You know,
if anyone can do it, Harry, you can. But actually, I've raised a ridiculously high what I thought I would get. I've got to about 3,200, which is beyond my wildest dreams. So.
And with your mates, that is a good tough going.
Most of them can't get a pint, so there you go. So I've that is actually, you know, race aside, that has probably been the biggest takeaway from it was actually how satisfying that has felt and how kind of overwhelmed I've felt by all my friends' generosity. And,
awesome.
And actually, it's been quite an amazing mechanism to reconnect with people that I had never anticipated, where people, you know, who I maybe went to school with 25 years ago.
You were suddenly knocking on their door, asking them for money.
You know, I might have posted a cheeky link on Instagram or something, you know, and then suddenly 50 quid comes through from someone you were at school at in year 6. And actually, so then, you know, I'm a polite lad. I'll drop on Instagram, drop a message saying thank you. And there's a couple of times where that's then led to a pint and a reconnection, which has actually been really, really nice.
Yeah.
So if you do want to reconnect with me, Just Giving link will be in the page. Drop me 50 quid and I'll take you for a beer. But you know what? There was actually, because you get, you know, you have to decide on whether you're going to do it around Christmas time. This year, because it was the first year it moved from October back to April. So it was quite a short kind of period between. And I had, you know, around Christmas, you end up with these weeks where you've got stuff planned in advance miles away, but you don't necessarily appreciate that suddenly they're all in the same week. And there was a week where I had like an awards thing on a Wednesday, a birthday on a Thursday, another birthday on a Friday, and I think a stag do on a Saturday.
In December. When it was the World Cup as well, add a span of words.
And I just remember, I was on the sofa on Sunday, and I was like, I'm not 25 anymore. And I felt like just horrendous. And I thought, I need to fucking do something with my life. Sorry for swearing.
That's okay.
And literally the email dropped into my inbox on that Sunday, offering me a place on this team. And I thought, let's do it. Let's make a positive change. So I took the place and that led me to here.
What was the and a massive congrats on the amount that you've
thank you
raised, by the way. That's
and thank incredible. You Harry for also donating, much appreciated and unexpected.
What was the furthest you'd run before
I'd done the Edinburgh Half when I was at uni still, so that there's
that's a good distance to run at uni.
Well, I did it. Yeah, I did it in my sixth year there when I was partying less because my work was quite a lot. Mm. But there was quite a sort of demoralizing moment where, because I was running for a charity, they kind of twinned you with a running coach to kind of give you a program of how to attack the sort of training plan. And as part of that, you have to fill in a questionnaire of saying, right, you know, what's your aspirations for this race? You know, do you have a time in mind? And at one point, you had to fill in your best 5K time, your best 10K time, your best half marathon, your best marathon. So I obviously hadn't done a marathon. And it said, and also, can you tell us when it was? And all of my records were from like 2015. And I was like, geez, why didn't I do this 10 years ago? But yeah, so I'd done a half marathon before. But then kind of in the last couple of years, I wouldn't go much further than 10K.
Yeah.
And maybe one run a week. And a bit of five-a-side football. I was by no means a kind of regular runner, would say. Yeah.
What was the 16 weeks training program?
I think actually it was 20. Yeah, 20. Because they got us on pretty early, start of December. So, yeah, about 20 weeks.
Your training was exceptional. For someone who ran once a week,
yeah,
you were smashing out some very, very fast distances quite early on.
Training, and actually there's a lot of reasons why I enjoyed the training, but I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. Especially when you anticipate training through the winter, a lot obviously the mornings are pretty cold and dark and there is a misery to that, but I enjoyed the training way more than I thought I would, and I enjoyed the routine of it.
Yes.
And I enjoyed, because I'm very lucky that I was twinned with this kind of guy who gave me a program, because I would have had absolutely no idea how to approach a marathon training. But the way that he did, and kind of mixing it with intervals and longer runs, meant that I could see the progress very, very obvious, very quickly. So even things like every now and again, not doing a long run and doing a 5K and shaving 2 minutes off my 5K time over a month, like it was just crazy. And that, which obviously gave you that kind of satisfaction to keep pushing it and keep feeling it and going on.
It can become quite addictive, running, I think, almost as much, if not more, than any other sport, because it's so easily measurable, right? You know exactly how far you've run and how fast you've done it in. And naturally, just by turning up time and time again, you're going to get quicker, you're going to go further. And which is a good thing.
You just have to show up most of the time and you're going to improve. Yeah.
And then the big day came.
Big day came, yeah.
How was it? Focus on the... how was it? What were the goods? Start with the goods and then the not so goods.
Yeah, this has all been leading into
the big
climax. The elephant in the room that was the actual day.
Which, PS, I mean, not good for you, but great for me in the concept of this pod.
The anticipation is brewing in this podcast. Maybe we should move on and talk about something else. We'll come back to this and get the listeners.
Leave them on a cliffhanger.
Leave them hanging on. There's not an excuse here, but I had a bit of flu the week before. But actually, going into the day, I felt strong. I felt good. Followed all the same stuff I'd done on my previous long runs. You know, in training, I'd probably run 33K. I think that was probably my furthest.
Yeah.
Decent distance.
Very good. For those not so familiar with the European measurement system, that's within 10K of the full distance. So within 6 miles.
So, yeah, 3 hour run. You know, if at a time that you'd hopefully be doing it in 3:40-ish.
Yeah.
So, you know, majority of it, you'd think, broken the backbone of it. The big day came, and, well, the first thing, the first clue that this was not going to be the day I planned was the train from Peckham Rye to Blackheath broke down.
Oh.
So I was stuck on a train which got increasingly hot for about 20 minutes with a bunch of other sweaty runners.
Okay, so flu, train, any more excuses you want to...
The big one. If anyone listening will know this, but, you know, you have to get to the start line a good hour or so before you're supposed to leave. And on this unfortunate Sunday, the rain was pissing down. And
Unlucky, genuinely unlucky.
And I'd made the mistake of not... Because, you know, people tell you, take a bin bag or something before and you can wear it and then just discard it. Mm. I didn't do that. I forgot about that. So I was in my little running vest, you know.
Did you not coat up?
I had a jumper, which, you know, I discarded at the start line. But obviously, within Chelsea 10 minutes. With Mudrick on the back. I don't need this. I had a jumper which I was, you know, give to charity, but obviously within 10 minutes in that rain, that jumper was sodden through. You wait around in the rain, and then for the first sort of hour or so of the run, the rain kind of carried on. And anyway, I was absolutely loving it. You know, I didn't feel the effects of the rain whatsoever.
Because what time were you going for context?
So I was pacing myself for roughly a 3:45, which, so...
Very good.
I was aiming to clock a kilometre about 5:20. But, you know, started out probably a little quick, but, you know...
You can't not, though. The excitement, it's impossible the to,
yeah.
crowd.
So yeah. I was doing my best to hold myself back, and basically for the first... Well, up until... Yeah, it's confusing me swapping to miles now. Mile 21, I was clocking at basically between 5:15 and 5:20.
Per K.
Yeah. And, you know, loving it. You know, the whole marathon experience is coming true. I've got my name on my vest. Everyone is encouraging me.
Yeah.
You know, my mum has come down, my girlfriend, my friends. You know, I've spotted them all. They've made signs. And then, yes, mile 21 hits. And I'm on a long sort of stretch of road.
Hang on.
Yeah.
Keep the listeners in suspense. Oh. So, mate, how was your time in Shanghai? Yeah. No, I'm joking. Mile 21.
Oh. Let me take a sip of beer before I get to this bit.
A monstrous corona from you. I've never seen such a big corona in my life. Yeah. What size? Is that 620 mil?
Yeah.
Ooh.
We're not messing around on this podcast.
Big daddy.
Mile 21. So, yeah, going from feeling good, feeling like I was actually about to have a bit of a push on for the last, you know, last 7 or 8K. No, less than that. Yeah. Literally within 30 seconds.
So you navigated... Canary Wharf, yep. Which is
the worst,
hellacious,
but actually it was amazing because it was so busy.
Yeah,
because I feel like everyone who had warned me about Canary Wharf said that it was quite a long stretch as well. It was a bit dead, not much atmosphere, and I feel like most of my friends had gone to Canary Wharf, but everywhere it was like 3 or 4 deep at least.
Interesting.
And so loud. Like,
I found it incredibly claustrophobic. I almost thought like the size of the buildings there. And probably...
Yeah. I guess, that's you know, I'm an architect. I'm used to tall buildings, so maybe I didn't throw me off the same way like a regular
human. Yeah. It's mere mortals.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's where I... Yeah, that's where I just...
That's where you hit your wall.
And it was about 3 minutes after I gave the boys, like, the Icelandic clap, you know, giving it, like, the big one, and then
great
just went around, went around the corner and just, yeah, died a pitiful death.
Yeah.
But anyway... Enough about my marathon.
Yeah.
plenty more of that to come.
Enough about your well-paced marathon. Yeah.
Mile 21.
Yeah. So, yeah, mile 21. Literally, yeah, feeling good, feeling great. And then 30 seconds later, the next thing I know, I'm at the side of the road and I don't know where I am. I've stumbled and I've been caught, miraculously, by my friend.
The chances
of that, you know, obviously, he had me on the app, but he was actually waiting with one of his other mates who was looking for another friend. And I don't really remember. I don't really remember. So I veered towards the side of the road and kind of propped myself up on like a water station and then tried to carry on a bit. And then that's when my mate found me and, basically stopped with him and had a cinnamon bun in his bag, which he fed me. Which maybe did the trick. Anyway, long story short, ended up in St. John's Ambulance tent, followed by the back of an ambulance. And what had happened was, according to the doctor, basically because I was absolutely drenched through with this rain, and then basically this stretch was quite long and exposed, especially after Canary Wharf, the wind was kind of really coming across it. And basically what happened apparently was hit the vest and brought my body temperature down to just a ridiculously low level to the point where my brain couldn't really function properly.
God.
So I ended up in the back of an ambulance with blood tests, ECG monitors, a rather intrusive thermometer check.
Where did they put that? Just out of pure curiosity.
Yeah, I'll demonstrate for the...
Do you want to use my finger to demonstrate?
No, I'm not ready for that yet, Harry.
That's the afterpod.
But yeah, basically, so I ended up in the ambulance and with one of those kind of comedy four blankets on, and was in there for about an hour until they said that my body temperature was ready to go. And the doctor said, right, it's time for you to go home. Can someone put you in a cab? And I was like, well, you know, I feel like shit. Because obviously at this point, I've been sitting in an hour, I'm cold, my legs are just full of cramp. I can't even move my legs.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I'm at this point, I was like, right, I'm just going to try, see if I can walk it a little bit. Yeah. So I literally borrowed a jacket off my mate, like a big wool jacket.
No way.
And one of those foil blankets. And so I started walking. And the ambulance guy wouldn't actually let me leave on my own to even walk. So my girlfriend, who had by this point joined us, walked with me.
I love it.
Back on the course. Shout out to Fiona. So together we walked the course. And at this point, I can barely move my legs because it was full of cramp. So
did she actually then get onto the...
Yeah, because it was one of those bits before it was like full barrier.
Okay.
So she actually got on the course.
Oh, wow.
And then quite quickly after that, that's when the full barriers came in.
Oh,
and so it was quite a weird, was quite an interesting sight, because obviously I had this big full blanket on and she's there in like jeans, trainers and like, you know, cagoule or whatever. And looks like the most casual mouth of money you've ever seen in your life. But anyway, so I managed to walk for about 3-4K slowly and painfully. But you know, at that point you really feel like the sympathy and obviously support of people watching. And you know, that kind of kept me going.
So that's interesting, because did you find when people, because obviously you had your name on your vest,
yeah,
so people were shouting your name, did you find that a help or a hindrance? Because I almost find that when you're in like dark place and people are shouting your name and you're obviously not going at the pace that you want to, you can almost feel like a little bit of shame and a bit of like you just want to hide.
When
did it kind of motivate you?
When I was running, I think I found it a positive.
Yeah.
I felt like it definitely gave me a bit of a boost.
Yeah.
But when I was walking,
yes,
that positivity turned to more like sympathy, which kind of started to really compound my misery.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've kind of glossed over, but like there was a point in that, you know, when I was in the back of the ambulance on my own, freezing cold, staying up at top of an ambulance, and I was like, well, I'm not going to finish this. And, you know, I was absolutely distraught. Like, you know, you've trained for 5 months for something, trained well and been enjoying it, and then suddenly you're in a situation that you didn't expect to happen. And you're just thinking, how have I got to this point? So I was angry, was the big thing, because I didn't know who to blame. Obviously, you know, you want someone to blame at
Greg.
This point.
I'd blame Greg.
Yeah, so Greg was the first name on my lips. And then it was genuine, probably one of the most despairing moments of my life.
Yeah.
In the back of my mind. Because at that point, I was like, there's no way I'm going to finish this marathon.
Yeah.
I can't even lift my leg.
Yeah.
I can't even feel my legs because I'm so cold. So anyway.
And it's an important point to make, actually. And I know that someone might think, oh my God, is that genuinely one of the worst moments of his life that he's... It sounds very privileged.
Yeah, yeah,
however,
yeah.
When you have been working towards something for 5 months, and it's kind of weird because it almost becomes one of, if not the most important thing in your life, not just the training, but the raising money for the charity.
Yeah.
So it could be easy to dismiss the fact that that's one of the darkest moments of your life, but it was such a big thing, your first ever marathon, the London Marathon,
the
importance.
And I think the charity thing is a big part of it.
Because
you've managed to persuade your friends and your family to, you know, in a time where people don't have a lot of spare cash, to donate over $3,000 of money.
Yeah.
And you're there not finishing what you said you're going to do.
Yeah.
And actually that was very much the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, because it's not just yourself.
It's
going
not,
down
yeah.
to charity. It's
And the charity themselves, RNIB, were like phenomenal the whole way through. And I, you know, I will want to do more with them going forward because they're such an amazing charity. And it's things like knowing that, you know, there was a big charity pub at the end where they were all going to celebrate together. And I was like, well, I'm not going to get to do that. I'm not going to turn up there without a medal. You know, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to enjoy the sort of camaraderie of the whole thing and, you know, celebrate with my friends that I've met on this thing. So yeah, you know, you're right, it does sound like a privileged thing, but it, you know, it becomes your entire life.
Yes.
At that point.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, when you're training through the winter and that kind of stuff. It was my big focus, really. So yeah, it was pretty dark. So yeah, as I said, I kept kind of walking, and then when there was about 2 or 3K left, I knew there was, basically what it was, I knew there was another, RNIB had two cheer points. Official ones where, you know, they had the big banner up and all the kind of guys were there supporting.
How many runners did they have?
I think they had about 40 or 50.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
And so I knew they had a cheer point at mile 24 or 25. And I was like, I don't want to walk past them like this, looking like I do. So when I knew it was going to be close, I was like, right, I'm going to just have to do it. So I gave him a blanket away, gave my friend back his jacket. Fiona got off the course. And I jogged the last sort of, I don't know, 2 or 3K.
Yeah.
So I did have that kind of feeling of jogging across the finish line. But, you know, we were talking before we started, it's like, you kind of have this this idea of running down the marathon, and obviously there's that iconic image of running down the mall and crossing that line with everyone around you. And for me, it wasn't that in any way, and it was more, I guess, anger at myself and disappointment. I didn't even put the medal around my neck when I finished. I just put it in my pocket.
You have it around your neck now, though. Yeah, I haven't been able to take it off all week.
Fused.
No, yeah.
And actually, and it was really a flat feeling crossing, and that was pretty miserable.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I actually found running down Pall Mall quite anticlimactic. I think in my head I built it up, but because it's the posh seats, isn't it? Because
yeah, you've got, it's actually where there's probably
the least amount of atmosphere. Yeah, you've just got the, you know, the VIPs, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you finish like probably, what would you say, about a third down the way Pall Mall. So you've still got like 2/3 of the bloody thing to walk.
Yeah.
And all you want to do is sit down and see your mates.
Yeah, and you've got to somehow get up to Horse Guards
Parade. Yeah,
20 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was my marathon experience. Mm. And it's,
a rather apt time to open this little Tennent's here.
Oh, join us. So we're
a little throwback to Scotland, this, actually.
Yeah.
There we go.
Lovely.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
So I feel like when you finish something like that, not just a marathon, but obviously ran a marathon, so that's the example we're going to use. You go either one of two ways. You're like, right, never again.
Yeah.
Or, got something to prove here. Unfinished business. Yeah. We go again. Where are you?
Well, there's a big demon that needs exercising.
Yeah.
And it's now a case of, do I try and run something soon, like in the next 6 months, or do I somehow I've managed to raise $2,000 again and run London again, which I think is what I really need to do.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, what, you know, we'll go on to sort of what's healthy from a sort of mental point of view. Mm. I put a lot of pressure on myself, generally, in things that I do. And I think, you know, there was a pressure that I put on myself to get a time for this marathon, which probably was, it was probably, you know, contributed to why I, you know, wasn't that well, because I pushed myself too hard.
Yeah.
But I can already imagine 12 months out, you know, 360 days away, what pressure am I going to be putting on myself for running that marathon again? And I already know that that's probably not a sensible move from a mental health point of view. But, you know, at the same time, I know that if I do it and I enjoy it and I succeed in what I want to do, that feeling will be 10 times better than if I'd done it the first time because of what I've gone through last
time.
So that's the dilemma I'm having to deal with. And actually, is that the way that I can get over the sort of feelings I have right now about what happened on Sunday? Is having that idea in my head to kind of redeem it.
And to touch on the mental health front, obviously that's quite detrimental to your mental health, but did you find, this is probably a bit of a leading question, did you find there was benefit in having something to train towards, something to almost... Well, it was difficult because it must have been tough, because also, am I right in thinking, so you started your own business?
Yeah.
A couple of months ago.
I started it officially in sort of October. Yeah.
So it's been going like 6-7 months.
Mm-hmm.
Similar sort of time overlapping with when you were training. How did you... What? So firstly, I suppose, what was the impact that having those two new big things in your life, what impact did that have on your overall existence and mental health, I suppose?
I think it's one of those ones where, you know, they are particularly starting a business is obviously a big life decision, big risk, you know, that kind of thing. And then obviously undertaking a marathon training plan is, you know, a big kind of commitment of time.
Yeah.
But actually, so, you know, on paper, it sounds like a terrible idea to do both those things at once. But in reality, it gave me many positives in that it gave me a balance to my life, which I think would have been very easy to have not had if I'd done just one of them.
Yeah.
So especially when you start a business, the kind of instinct is like, I must work 24 hours a day to make this the best success it can possibly be.
Interesting.
So actually what the marathon training did was kind of ground me in something else, which meant that I couldn't necessarily give all my time to the business, which, you know, in reality is a good thing. It's a healthy thing to have sometimes have a bit of distance from it. And it was when I was running, it was the only time really in the day that my mind was totally clear. Every other moment, you know, I'm thinking of what can I do? You know, is there something else I can be doing to be, you know, networking or pushing the business or thinking about accountants, thinking about insurance, that kind of stuff, which the stuff that you have to learn really quickly when you start a business. The running was the kind of calm. The running was the quiet in that madness, in the frenzy. So actually, it brought this balance that I didn't really anticipate that positive from it.
Yeah, it almost gave you a bit of respite from what would have otherwise been always on.
Exactly. It was the mental versus the physical. So like, the mental was like going for 24 hours a day, but that physical time meant that the brain could rest.
Yes.
Because actually in that time, all I was thinking was, right, I've got to do 2 minutes at this pace and then walk for 60 seconds and then 3 minutes at that pace, whatever it is. And that was all consuming. And I didn't think anything about the business, which was amazing.
So you weren't like listening to like, I don't know, business podcasts just completely separate.
Exactly.
And I imagine that's incredibly beneficial because, to use a bit of an investing analogy, it's almost like diversifying, because if hypothetically you didn't have the marathon, you'd have been all consumed in your business. And if your business went tits up,
which
it still might, but your kind of life by definition would have probably gone tits up as well.
Yeah.
But when you've got the marathon as well and other things in your life that you're working towards, then if one element of your life goes to shit, then you've still got the other areas to kind of soften the blow and to focus on. So I can imagine, to give you that balance.
It was really beneficial. And I guess it could be a downside is I tried as much as possible not to let it impact like social life, because I'm a very social person. I get my energy from spending time with people and hanging out with friends and doing things and being busy. And I didn't want to become one of those people who was just training for a marathon and, you know, therefore couldn't do anything. But what it did mean was that on like the sort of Wednesday evening or the, you know, Tuesday night, I wouldn't go to the pub and have 3 pints. It meant that, you know, I could still do the fun stuff, you know, the big events, you know, I could still see my friends, but I would be a bit more like controlled when it came to like just the kind of really random socializing that you end up just regretting probably the next day because it wasn't necessary. And especially given, you know, when I took the marathon place, I felt so bad because of the amount that I was drinking and going out. That was quite a nice positive from the whole thing as well, that it felt like I learned to sort of moderate it a bit better.
It kind of streamlines all your decisions because when you're working towards such a big thing, it may be slightly oversimplified, but you think, will this thing benefit my marathon? Yes or no? Yes, I'll do it. No, I won't do it. So it almost works as a filter in that regard through which you can make all your life decisions, you know, and that can be quite beneficial.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's it. And you learn to kind of evaluate a little bit better about what you want to do and where you find joy and where you find value. And the big thing that got cut out in this whole 6 months was golf.
This is huge.
Yeah, which is...
this is huge.
Which is, that's the one now.
When was the last time you played golf?
November.
Serious?
Yeah. So, for context for the podcast.
Oi, oi, oi.
Basically, you know, There's a group of us who would golf, you know, not every week necessarily, but, you know.
There or thereabouts.
There or thereabouts. And, you know, but more so for the social, you know, none of us are Tiger Woods by any means, but...
Not a golf course, anyway.
But when you're... Yeah, well, I guess that was the thing that I sacrificed through this whole process. Because, you know, if you're doing a 2.5 hour run on a Saturday...
Mm. No time.
Convincing yourself and others that you can then spend 4 hours on a golf course is a bit of a hard sell.
I thought my exceptional golf at Shirley Park that time might have put you off.
Yeah. Well, actually, do you know what? I'm more that I'm trying to emulate you these days, actually.
Talking of socialising.
Yeah.
The pub quiz that you ran as a charity fundraiser was exceptional fun. And I actually owe you a public apology because I heckled you for a fact that I said was wrong. And then it turned out to be right. Yeah, because one of the questions was, when did Paula Radcliffe have a shit during the marathon? And I thought it was 2004 Athens Olympics, but it was 2005 London Marathon.
Yeah, well, that's an apology accepted. You know, we'll move on.
Did you need a poo in the ambulance? Did you do a Paula?
No, otherwise the guy with the thermometer would have known about it. No, my bowels were strong, actually. I had a good chat with a... There was a lady running for the same charity who I was catching up with after the race, who is an actress who I will not name, and she had a big problem with her bowels as generally... Oh, this is terrible content for the podcast.
No, that's quite interesting.
But she...
But only if you name drop who I'm taking.
She had been worrying a lot before, to the point where she said she popped 3 Imodium in the start pen.
Oh, wow.
Right? That's how scared she was about it. And then a further 2 on the course.
Jesus.
Yeah, so, I mean, good luck to her, wherever she is now.
So, business-wise,
yeah.
What made you want to start your own business and how's it going?
Good question.
Thank you.
I guess it's something I have always wanted to do. I think with something like architecture, it is, I guess, more common than a lot of industries to start your own company because there's a lot of small architects.
Mm.
You know, there's not necessarily a lot of small marketing brands or small kind of lawyer firms, for example. So it's always been something that's been on my kind of horizon of something I've wanted to do. Why now? I think it was basically kind of born out of the pandemic where...
Mm.
You know, obviously everyone went to working from home and I was working for a practice in London and, you know, for what, 2 years or so, I was working at home and I just basically was kind of autonomous on it. I'd check in with my boss once a week, but otherwise I'd just kind of get my head on and get down and get my head down and get on with it. So there was a kind of feeling of I'm kind of just doing it my own anyway. Mm. With something like architecture, there's a kind of authorship, which I kind of have always wanted, where, you know, it's a bit like, you know, I'm sure if you're a lawyer, you're always working with someone else's name on the door, yeah. Right?
Yes.
And with something that's, you know, so creative, you do the whole project, but it's published under someone else's name and someone else will get the kind of credit for it and the kind of that sort of thing. And, you know, having your own authorship has always been something that's appealed to me. You know, having that kind of total control of, you know, what something is, what the finished product is and how you get there. And that's really appealing.
Why do you think?
I think because in a way you're doing it anyway.
Yeah, so you want the credit.
Well, it's more that you want to be able to get there in your own way.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and even make the wrong steps yourself and kind of learn from it. But, and so basically the reason it happened was it was quite out of chance where post-lockdown... my friend Utsav, who we mentioned before, he had moved. So basically, for context, we had met... So we met in Shanghai together. We were working for the same architecture practice in Shanghai. Although he had actually gone to Edinburgh as well, but he was two years below me.
Oh, wow.
So we met in Shanghai and we were good mates before we kind of worked together. And then he moved to London after I'd come back. And we basically went for a pint one night. And we both effectively said the same thing of, you know, we feel like we're doing our job you know, sort of
yeah. Without the recognition.
Exactly. Well, no. More that we were doing it so autonomously from our bosses that we were like, well, you know, it feels like I could just do this myself.
Yeah.
And we both just sat in the pub and we thought, yeah, that's true. And then we had a few more pints and we were like, oh, fuck it, maybe we should just, should we think about doing something ourselves? And we had the kind of few pints and we said that and then we kind of left it. And then sort of a couple of weeks later, we were like, have you thought any more about it? We're like, yeah, actually we have. Yeah, I have as well, yeah. Yeah, maybe we should think about it. And then that kind of really sort of started to formalise. And then next thing you know, we've registered at company's house.
Amazing. What's your company's name?
We are Studio Mango, like the fruit.
Ah, okay. Okay, right. This makes sense because Utsav had a sign saying Go Mango with pictures of mangoes on it.
Yeah, that
would
be it.
Which looked more like carrots.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
But side note,
but, you know,
and I quite liked it, but I don't think I got it.
You just thought it was a fun pun.
Yeah,
Studio Mango is the name.
Okay, great.
Yeah, we wanted something actually that was like not super formal. I feel like so many architecture practices are like Davis and Jane Design or Davis and Jane Architects. So it all feels a little bit, last sort of century.
Yeah.
And also we've got quite a few friends who are product designers, graphic designers, that kind of thing. So actually something that's a bit more generic gives us a bit more scope to be flexible in terms of, you know, maybe there'll be projects that aren't strictly architecture in the future that we can collaborate with people, that kind of thing. And also, you know, our first two projects came from one lady who had visited Utsav in India and he gave her some mangoes and she gave us our first project.
Oh, so
there was a bit of a kind of origin to it as well.
So you're mooching off Utsav's clients, basically.
Exactly.
Have you bought in any business?
not till this day, no. But, you know, to anyone listening who needs some good architecture, I'll recommend someone. And if you need mediocre, come to us.
What sort of area of architecture is it? Do you specialise in?
Well, it's a good question right now because, you know, when you start practice, particularly in London, you imagine the bread and butter is going to be residential, which it is. You know, that's what we're doing predominantly. But we also have, quite bizarrely at the moment, we have an old friend of ours who used to work with us in Shanghai who set up his own practice. He has been approached by a client to do a hotel, which he can't basically do on his own. So he's asked us to help him. So we're collaborating with another practice in China, in Shanghai, to do a new Sheraton hotel.
In London?
In China.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is obviously absolutely bonkers because it's the sort of scale of project that we could work 25 years in London and not get easily, you know.
That's crazy.
And it's also because it's China, it's on super speed, which means they want to start building it in November. And we only started it about a month ago.
Amazing.
Watch that space. But
that must be decent. And there's me buying dinner somewhere. Yeah. Fucking hell. But that through business expenses.
Yeah, let's see how that goes. But so it's a bit of, it's quite fun because we will literally flip between designing a 150 room hotel to someone's kitchen extension.
Yeah.
From one day to the next. And
amazing.
It feels all a bit bizarre. But it's
the diversity of work keeps it interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean that's what's fun. I enjoy about architecture is no day is the same, right? No, you know, you could have the same, you know, you could be neighbours, but the client would be different. They'll have different aspirations of what they want. So no project ever feels the same. And you're doing something different every single day, which keeps it interesting, keeps it fresh, keeps it fun.
How was your time in Shanghai? How long were you there for? Was it
3 years?
3 years, yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was, I'd say, between that and university, kind of the most formative years of my life. Like, you know, school you get through. For me, I got through school, right?
Yeah.
And then university is when you have that choice of who you want to hang out with more, right?
Yeah. And you chose Greg.
No. The universe chose Greg. Yeah. I didn't choose Greg. I'll give you some context quickly to that. I had done my undergrad at Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And then was going to enter fifth year. So obviously most of my mates, and I actually quite deliberately had a lot of my mates weren't architects because I liked to have a bit of, I didn't want to go home and just talk shop. So most of my friends weren't architects, which meant after 4 years, they all pissed off home.
Yeah.
And I was in a position where I didn't really know that many people. So I had a good friend of mine. We were looking for a flat And she had a job lined up in Edinburgh. And then that fell through. So about 3 weeks out from university starting, I didn't have anywhere to live. So I dug the depths of Gumtree, put my life in my own hands and looked for a place to live in Gumtree. And this, what looked like an unbelievable flat came up on George IV Bridge, for anyone who knows Edinburgh, bang in the middle of the town.
Beautiful place.
Beautiful place. And at a really good rate. It said there is a resident, you know, someone there you all live with.
The downside.
And anyway, I saw who it was because they said, you know, this is the person you'll be meeting. And I saw I had a mutual friend. So I dropped a line to the mutual friend and said, what's this guy like?
Who was it?
Tommy Pollock.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he said something like, yeah, he's a pretty good bloke. I think he likes the Fosters. But it was definitely a negative. Anyway. So I'm aware that this flat is really good. I can afford it. And it's literally 3 minute walk from my university building.
Yeah.
So I'm like, right, I'm going to put the hard set in. So I turn up with an 8-pack of Fosters to this flat view. And anyway, we look on the flat and it's stunning. Absolutely beautiful. And anyway, we sit and we basically end up consuming 8 beers together.
Yeah.
We get on well. And by the end of it, he offered me the flat. So amazing. Like, oh, fucking great. Later, he let me know that he'd already offered it to a girl before. So he then had to have the awkward conversation with that girl.
He
then had to rescind the offer to her because he'd asked me to move in. So that's how I met Greg, and that's obviously how I met you, Howie.
Mm.
Long story. How did I get to that? I can't remember.
Formative years,
university.
In Shanghai,
When this university finished, I was looking for a job, and I didn't really want to be in London because that's where I grew up, as I said. So I applied for jobs in London and in Shanghai. In New York, Shanghai, and in Copenhagen, because they were cities that I thought would be quite cool to live in. And I got offered a job in Shanghai, so I moved there. And what was amazing about there is, the first thing is, you know, you're in an amazing place to travel because I could go to Seoul for the weekend and Tokyo is an hour's flight away, you know, that sort of thing. Cheap to live, you know, you can go out and have a dinner and beers for £2 or £3, no problem. But then it was just such a nice is a boring word, but amazing quality of life in that you had friends there who were become friends for life because you'd meet people there who you knew instantly. I always thought of it like they would pass like the first 4 tests of my friendship level because I knew that they were outgoing because they're living in China. They're adventurous. They're interesting people. They're already there. So it's like, you know, as soon as you meet someone, they're already ticking so many boxes that you'd look for to being a friend.
What's the fourth box of your
audition? What did I say? Audition. Adventurous.
Outgoing, adventurous, sociable.
Brave.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
There you go.
And attractive.
Attractive is goes without saying. what that meant was that the people that you met there, you very, very quickly became very close because obviously you were so far from home that you didn't have, you know, the family network or friend network really you had. So you very quickly built a network of very, very strong friends that you would spend pretty much every day and every night with very quickly because, you know, there was not much else to do. You'd kind of cling to each other as your support network. It was an amazing time to just do some really fun stuff and live in an amazing city and just live in a kind of crazy, mad world for 3 years.
You left before it got proper crazy, though.
Yeah,
right. But what was it like living in China? Like, what were the similarities between here and what were the big differences? Like, the big differences?
The differences are enormous, but like the thing that I would always like that's easy to compare for me is something like a commute, right? My commute in, say, if I was cycled to work here, you'd know what you're going to. You might get cut by a bus, almost killed by a taxi driver, and someone would shout at you. My commute there, I'd ride to work, and there'd be a guy in front of me with a crate of ducks on the back squawking at me. And then there'd be, you know, some guy with an umbrella up and so many boxes he can't see that he almost kills me. And that was that kind of like, every day that I left the house, it felt like I was playing a video game.
Nice.
And that was what was quite fun. Like, it always felt like this fresh experience that you just had no idea what was going to happen. But it's quite easy in London to kind of get into routine and kind of live a little bit like on autopilot sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you know what you're going to get. Whereas there was none of that ever in China because it's just so crazy and chaotic the whole time. which, you know, has its downsides, because sometimes you just want to have a day that's like, you just want to have simplicity and normality. And, you know, you, if you've had a really tough day at work, you know, if you're working long hours and you're going home and you don't have, like, you know, your mum to call, the last thing you want is some bloke shouting at you in a language you don't understand because you're standing on the wrong side of the thing or whatever it is, you know, like, that suddenly becomes incredibly in your face and alien and really sort of kind of rejecting, you know, they reject it in a way that, like, sometimes you want that normality that you couldn't get there, which...
Why did you move back?
I think it's a place that you can live very easily for a couple of years and you can enjoy. But I think once you get to a point where you maybe the you kind of get a bit used to, or you maybe you stop enjoying it, certain things in some ways, or you maybe you've travelled as much as you want to travel.
The novelty
kind of starts to wear off, and then that's when your kind of yearning for home maybe starts to increase. Where, and so for me, there was things like there was some family pulls to come back in terms of like maybe some ill health, that kind of thing, and there was just a kind of point where I got to the point where the balance didn't feel like it was weighing heavily enough to stay there. That it felt like I was starting to regret not being back here for various reasons. And actually, typically, you'd find most people would do a... It's quite a cyclical place in terms of people go in for 2-3 years, maybe even less, and then go out again, just because they kind of... You kind of burn out almost in a way, because you work intensely.
Is it? What's, yeah, was it?
So like... I'd probably do sort of, I don't know, 8 till 7 work every day, and then maybe one day of the weekend potentially. But then you go out after that, you go out for dinner, you go out for drinks, you go home, you sleep, go to work.
Yeah.
So it is a very like full on lifestyle. You don't really have any kind of off lazy days, I suppose.
Yeah. What's Shanghai like for a night out?
Shanghai.
That little giggle.
Do you know what? There's so many different routes you can take. And so, you know, a couple of friends, Greg included, came to visit me. And what I tried to do was show them the different sides of what you can do. So there's like, Shanghai is a very international city, right?
Yeah.
So, but it is also this incredible Chinese cultural city in terms of there's modern Chinese culture there is probably bigger than anywhere else in the world. So, you know, there's lots of really, really cool Chinese clubs that are, you know, have amazing DJs and have amazing things like that, which are great. And then on the flip side of that, you have the sort of really high-end, like, Western-oriented clubs that are, like, to sort of, you know, if someone like the F1's in town, Lewis Hamilton's going to this club.
Okay.
And there's one famous one called Mint, which has a shark tank in the middle of it.
Okay.
With sharks literally swimming around in the middle of this club. And then on the other side, which is the side I also felt it was necessary to show my friends when they visited, was the kind of more sort of local Chinese club. And they have a very sort of specific view of Westerners in these clubs where I don't know how I ended up on this list, but I was on like effectively like a WhatsApp group where someone would send a message every day saying, right, if you want to go to a club tonight, here's the name and here's the guest list name. And so if I went to that club, I'd say the name on the door and I'd go in and I'd get free drinks all night. And the idea is that basically they want Western people to come into these clubs so that you can get really drunk and dance and that kind of thing. But it's like a really bizarre... Basically, you kind of get a lot of people sort of standing around a dance floor watching these kind of drunk Westerners dance, and you feel like you're in a zoo, and it is very, very odd.
Yeah.
So I didn't obviously do that very often, but I did show Greg that time when they...
They love that.
He did, yeah. They also gave like free cigarettes and all that. Yeah. That's where I lost him, actually. Yeah. So yeah, there was a few different ways you could approach a night, but the sort of first one, the kind of more sort of authentic Chinese one, was really, really good. Like, you get some amazing DJs and all sorts coming up. Yeah, you'd see someone like Thundercat, for example, came to Shanghai and played in a room for like 80 people in just this small club in Shanghai, whereas this guy's selling out stadiums, you know, all over the world. It's kind of insane.
Yeah. Love it. Would you go back?
I'd go back to visit. I'm not sure I could. There's a lot of it I miss about it, but I don't think I miss living there anymore.
Fergus Davis.
Mm.
Thank you.
No problem.
Sorry. Any final remarks, reflections, introspections, words of wisdom? knowledge bombs.
Failed to prepare. Prepared to fail.
How apt.
Yeah, given my marathon.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much for all the Game of Fives.
Catch you next time.
Yep.
Bye-bye.